So I've been talking about Susie for a long time, but it was probably time to kind of give everyone an update, let you know what we've been doing. Susie, as you'll see, there are a lot of Susie emeriti. A lot of people cut their teeth on Susie. The bold shows the present Susie team, which is mainly myself and a grad student and postdoc at Stanford, with a lot of help with data analysis from Ken Ganga, and then the usual suspects for help with the instrument. So this is familiar to all of those of you who've seen me talk many times before about Susie. It's a four-color, three-pixel bolometer array that operates at the Caltech Submillimeter Observatory. We have several similarities with that bar and several important differences. One is that good weather at this place is definitely not guaranteed. Forget whether the atmospheric fluctuations are higher or not. The question is, if you're out there for 10 days, you're going to be able to open the dome. And I speak from experience, we have not had data for a year. The other difference from ACBAR is we actually have very similar bands, except we don't have a 300 gigahertz band. But one thing that we do in Susie, which is kind of a good thing and a bad thing, is that each pixel observing the sky, we break the signal into three frequencies. It's a good thing because, as I'll tell you in a minute, our ability to do atmospheric subtraction is extremely good. It's a bad thing because this structure does not have very high optical efficiency. And in fact, 90% of the photons never make it to the bolometer, which is far from ideal. So at the end, I'll talk about how we're going to change that. So here are the specifications. Our pixels are about 1.5 arc minutes. They vary a little bit from frequency to frequency. And we difference pixels over a 5 arc minute chop. And we have a beam pattern that looks like this on the sky. So if you have a cluster going through, it should look like a cluster convolved with this beam. We have three bands to catch the decrement, the increment, and the null of the SE effect. This is the atmosphere from Mauna Kea when you can open the dome. Simultaneous multi-frequency coverage of each pixel is very good because we can actually remove the atmosphere based on... Uh-oh. Bear with me a second here. It's time people realize not everyone has lapels. So this is the temporal power spectrum of three channels of Susie. And although a power spectrum is not the ideal way to look for a correlation, you can certainly see that the features are pretty well identical in all the channels. And the degree of correlation is actually very good and enables us to clean the data. Yeah, that was millivolts. It's actually millivolts root hertz, not per hertz. That's an error.
How would you compare that in terms of real noise arcs? I have no idea what your calibration is.
I do not have the calibration number off the top of my head, but it's basically this is what you see in the data. So the relative ratios, the calibration is about a factor of two. Can vary things by about a factor of two, but roughly we see sort of 1 to about 3. To about 10 in our 350 gigahertz band. Susie, the high frequency channel of Susie can be configured for 350 gigahertz or 300 gigahertz, and we've tried both. We find actually that 350 gigahertz is a little better because it makes the spectra a little more orthogonal. As you can see, there's not a huge ratio between 1.1 and 1.4 millimeters. So what we do is we make a combination. I would be interested to talk to the ACBAR people and see how their method varies compared to ours. But what we do is we make a combination of the three channels that is free of two signals of interest that we think are in the data, and that is the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect and the kinematic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And the kinematic effect is, of course, spectrally identical to CMB fluctuations. So depending on whether we're looking at clusters or whether we're doing blank sky observations, we can use the same template for both. And what this figure down here is supposed to show you is what happens to our noise with atmospheric removal and without atmospheric removal. And actually, it works a little better at 220 gigahertz in this picture. But you can see that the noise levels are not actually very different in the two channels once you do the correlation. The thing you have to be careful of is the fact that, of course, once you take advantage of this correlation. It works very well, but of course then it makes your error bars correlated between the three channels. And so as Bill was pointing out, the analysis does get rather complicated, and you have to be careful to account for those correlations. Here's a typical data set. I just realized this morning I have no idea which cluster this is. I think it's MSO451, but I can't really remember. But this is what we do is we let the cluster drift through the beans, and so we just get these. We don't get maps, we just get single lines of data, but you can see the cluster going through at 2.1 millimeters, and you can see a hint of a increment at 850 microns, and then just noise at 1.4 millimeters. Here are some recent, in the last couple of years, measurements. Well, it would be the last couple of years before last year, because last year we didn't get any data, of a bunch of clusters. And so you can see that some of them were measured, that they've all been measured at 150 and 220 gigahertz. Some have then been measured at 300 gigahertz, and some have been measured at 350. And in general, we find that atmospheric subtraction works better if we have a 350 rather than a 300 gigahertz channel. But as I'll show you in a minute, actually, you would really rather have both, because the 300 gigahertz channel gives you quite good discrimination between thermal and kinematic Sunyaev-Zaldovich effect. The reason this error bar, in case you're curious, this was actually two separate runs where we have a 350 gigahertz channel and a 300 gigahertz channel. The reason that error bar is so big is because the atmospheric spectrum and the thermal and kinematic spectra are not sufficiently orthogonal for atmospheric removal to work that well. It works really well in these channels, but you really can't take anything out without completely taking out the signal in that channel. So that's why that error bar is so large. It's not a limitation of the receiver itself. And if we had a receiver with all four channels in, we would expect to be able to clean that channel rather nicely as well. But we can't do that yet. Yeah, note, these spectra are for display purposes only. So when this appears on the web, don't go and grab these intensities, okay? Because they're correlated, all right? They're correlated at about the 5 to 20% level, and our full analysis takes this correlation into account. So here are some preliminary results. What we did is we analyzed the cluster data to get an optical depth and a peculiar velocity. Lloyd, I think, will talk more tomorrow about why peculiar velocities are still interesting. Believe it or not, people do ask me this. Why are peculiar velocities still interesting? The answer is that they can help you measure the matter density. And you can see that for a number of clusters now, we're being able to get down to limits of about 500 to 700 kilometers per second. Some of the data, this was one of the days when we weren't being snowed on. So we got some data, but it wasn't terribly high quality. So what I'm going to show you now is I'm going to talk a little bit about what you can do with multi-frequency data. And this is sort of timely because I know that there have been papers recently. There was a paper by Holder recently on AstroPH about choices of frequency for measuring the SE effect. And this will be relevant when people start talking tomorrow about SE surveys. So what I'm showing you here, this is an analysis of our data to determine the likelihood of different values of optical depth and peculiar velocity. And the blue line shows you what happens if we just analyze the data from MSO4. Okay. Here, I'll let you stare at these spectra again while I try to get myself organized here. So what we're looking at is the data from MSO451. And that's an interesting one to look at for a number of reasons. First of all, because we actually have four spectral points, although one of them is not terribly high signal to noise. And also because there are actually four clusters in this pile here of clusters that overlap with measurements that have been made at OBRA and BIMA by John Carlstrom and people. So these are. So what we've done is we've combined our data with their data to do a multi-frequency analysis. So this is what happens if you just use SUSY data only. The blue is if you use that data on MSO451 without the 350 gigahertz channel. And this is the likelihood of a given peculiar velocity, and this is the likelihood of a given optical depth. And so then if we put in our 350 gigahertz channel, we do get some improvement, not a huge improvement in the peculiar velocity, and we get a little bit of improvement in the optical depth. But I want you to remember these pictures, because you'll see some more of them. And so you can see our peculiar velocity limit goes down. It's really, the biggest effect is actually on the higher limit, because this does actually fall to zero more quickly. But they're totally consistent. The optical depth that we get is completely consistent statistically with the two data sets. So now we can combine this spectrum actually with the measurement of MS0451, which has appeared in a couple of places recently, including this preprint from Reese et al. And this is what we've done here, is taken their temperature. I have 10 minutes left. Good, thank you. I've taken their temperature measurement and converted it to an intensity. And then we can actually fit a spectrum to all 5 points. And so now this is, the red again is SUSY all channels. I left out the 350 gigahertz this time. But so if we add in the Owens Valley data, then not surprisingly, the uncertainty in the optical depth really tightens up. I should add that we've used the exact same X-ray parameters to analyze both sets of data. When we analyze the SUSY data, we actually use the X-ray parameters that are in Reese et al. But the effect on the peculiar velocity is certainly non-negligible, so the limits go down a little bit more. But actually, to me, the most exciting thing about this is that the data are all completely consistent, which is very important. The frequencies are quite different. The sensitivity to point source contamination is completely different. So the overall data is more sensitive to radio point sources. We're more sensitive to dust in the cluster or to millimeter sources. Method of taking the data is different. So you've got an interferometer which will resolve at any very large angular scales in the cluster, whereas SUSY, with its larger beam and very large troptor, is quite sensitive to large angular scales in the cluster. So if for some reason the X-ray measurements of the cluster were missing some cool component of the gas, that would show up, that would be more likely to show up in the SUSY data than the OVRO data, but actually the data sets are completely consistent. This is something we've just started doing, and so we have three other clusters that we're in the process of comparing right now. So we find good agreement. We find that adding the radio point has the biggest effect on the tau measurement, but also gives you some improvement to the peculiar velocity limit. And so we're analyzing the other clusters. We can, of course, actually we can make some revised angular diameter distance estimates to these clusters using the combined data sets, but that's of limited value, really, because when you try to measure the Hubble constant with the Sunyaev-Zaldovich effect, the biggest contribution to the uncertainty is from systematic errors, and those are, of course, the same between the two data sets. So let me pause and move on to something different while I still have time. We have also used SUSY to make measurements of blank sky without any known sources in it. We're, although not as sensitive as ACBAR, we are able to look for CMB anisotropies. And Bill, of course, gave a good overview of why this was interesting. We also got a slightly smaller angular scales than ACBAR because our beam is only 1.5 arc minutes, so there is some value to these measurements. So what we did was surveyed a pretty small area of sky to about 38 microkelvin. We actually detect structure, and I'll talk about that. And we can use our multi-frequency coverage to determine what it is we've actually seen. And our measurements included this location, PC1643 plus 4631, which the SE aficionados amongst you may recognize as what we euphemistically call the Ryle cluster, which is the claimed detection of a Sunyaev-Zaldovich cluster by the Ryle group in Cambridge, England. So I should say straight ahead that, of course, our choice of fields was not unbiased. We did actually pick a field with some structure left in it. Okay, I should try and finish this up in 5 minutes. So here are our measurements. And this structure in the data that you see is real. And we can measure its, we can use our 150 gigahertz and 220 gigahertz channels to measure essentially its spectral index. We can look for a slope, and that slope should be 1 for CMB. And that slope is inconsistent with other possible sources, most noticeably SZ, but also dust. Strange enough, the thing it's closest to is free-free, but it's very unlikely that we would be seeing free-free at these frequencies, so we discount that. Also not shown here is the atmosphere. If we had, it's difficult to calculate the atmospheric residual spectrum because we actually do atmospheric removal, but if there was atmosphere that for some reason was not correlated between the channels and not removed, that slope will probably be about 3. So there's every reason to believe that what we see is CMB. Now, like we're still working on our power spectrum as well. We're trying to break it up into bins so that we can look at the high L bin that is less well probed by ACBAR. So I don't have that to show you today, except I will sort of give you the teaser that's consistent with our 97 upper limit, but it is actually a detection, and it appears that it might be consistent with CBI as well. So we looked at this field that had this cluster candidate in it, and we do actually detect something at the pointing center. This is the SUSY beam shape. This is what you would expect to see. And then we went through just for fun to see if we had anything else, and we found this other thing here that also had a shape that looked like it could be a cluster. And there's other funny stuff going on here which we didn't investigate. And we can use our different channels to try to distinguish true cluster candidates from CMB fluctuations. So what I've done here is replotted the MSO451 data with the over a point in terms of temperature, so you can compare. So this is what a thermal SD spectrum looks like. CMB spectrum is flat, and it turns out that, well, you can make the judgment call. Here's PC1643. This, I put the BIMA point up here slightly for fun. They were not analyzed with the same source model, and so I was saying to Bill that we need to go back and look at that data. But it is at least consistent with what we measure. So here's our one sigma error bar, and here are our spectral points. And the same thing with our other candidate. So we've got these two sources with really quite large intensities. Quite large temperatures, and that could be interesting. So I only have 3 minutes, so I don't have a lot of time to talk about future plans. But I'll just say that Stanford has very generously funded us to upgrade the instrument. Remember, I was telling you that we have low optical efficiency, so what we're doing right now is we're rebuilding SUSY to still use the same technique that we found so effective, which is to look at points on the sky simultaneously at more than one frequency, but instead of using the photometers, which have low optical efficiency, we're actually using a properly designed optical system with splitters, which should achieve much higher much higher optical efficiency, and that we hope will be commissioned in about 8 or 9 months from now. And then we're working on a plan right now to add diffraction limited arrays to try to get out point sources. So, and then we're going to also broaden up our bands. And I think I'll stop there. For those people who are interested, I can talk to you about other plans as well, such as measuring. Let me just say that these instruments, this is what we expect the new instrument to do compared with the old instrument and the old instrument plus OVRO. And I just want to make the point very quickly in the last couple of minutes that the next generation of experiments will be sufficiently sensitive that we've got to consider foregrounds, point sources, band uncertainties. So how well do you know the band of your instrument? Are 4 bands enough? We might need extra bands. And so to that end, we're going to actually put a Fourier transform spectrometer in front of the upgraded instrument to get more than 4 bands to see if this helps or not. So we're going to burn some sensitivity to get more spectral points, just in case there are foregrounds we have to worry about. So I probably better stop there and take questions. Yeah, I'll just leave you that one up there. That can be in the background one. This is what band uncertainties do to you. They give you a systematic peculiar velocity uncertainty. Phil.
The question of where to site your instruments is very important. And using the same detectors and filters that the South Pole people are using, essentially.
Yeah. Well.
Not
exactly the same, yeah.
But one should be able to draw a comparison between sites, given what you're measuring, your atmosphere transparency.
We have much more problem with the atmosphere than ACBAR does. I mean, sometimes we can't observe.
We're not removing atmosphere.
Right.
We essentially have atmosphere that's comparable.
Oh, I thought you said that you did have.
We do not.
Oh, okay, so you don't remove it. Okay. Yeah. Well, we remove it for the cluster analysis, but we can actually treat it as a noise statistic for the blank sky analysis. Yeah. But either way, it's basically the same technique, though. You still are basically taking account of frequency correlation. Surely, because you say that you don't make use of the fact that the temporal shape is the same in all channels. Huh. Okay.
We're just doing this in one picture.
Yeah.
The flush rate is not large enough.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. But to answer Phil's question, we're completely constrained where Susie goes. It goes on the CSO, so.
Yeah. Chris, keep in mind, how does one deal with the atmosphere given the many choices of where to field from? The difference between 35 kilometers, the South Pole, Chile, Mauna Kea, seem dramatic, but of course it depends on the frequency of the atmosphere.
Yeah, it depends on what you're trying to do. I mean, if you want to look at, if you want to do a cluster survey, then it doesn't really matter. You want to go for the best, in some ways, you might want to go for the best site. But if you want to look at known clusters, or if you want to have an instrument where you can actually, say, follow up on a cluster survey that's not at the South Pole, then you don't want to be at the South Pole, for instance. So, yeah, Lloyd.
So the first error table you had for configure velocity said MS0451, 1100, like plus or minus 400, or 400, 500, which, and then we never saw an error that small again on it.
Really? That's probably an error. That's probably what happens when you combine two talks from different. The error is about. It's about 600. Yeah. We do have another cluster that has lower peculiar velocity error bars than that, but that's because its tau is quite large. Because the peculiar velocity error depends on tau, it scales with tau. Part of the reason why we get such a big spread in peculiar velocity uncertainties is because it's a big spread in tau. If you're looking at a cluster with low optical depth, then your peculiar velocity error is big. I'm sorry? It's about 500.
So what's your conclusion? Is your conclusion that you have statistically detected peculiar velocities on N clusters?
No, we have the only cluster. I don't really want to go back and show the numbers because they might change. So one cluster does actually have a 3 sigma peculiar velocity, and it's big. But I don't think I want to stand up and say, hey, we detected a 2,000 kilometer per second peculiar velocity. I want to see what happens to that.
Yeah.
What was the question? I'm sorry?
The signature of
the Yes. Yeah, you can't distinguish them.
Yeah, so that your error includes that.
Yeah, some of those, yes, that whatever peculiar velocity we measure for a cluster will include CMB.
But presumably you can include, you know, that you have a full resolution that you can see the result clusters and can cluster.
Yeah, most of our clusters are partly resolved. So we are fitting to a given angular scale. So, but from our blank sky data, those two fluctuations I showed you where we've measured the spectrum, those are quite small. They're not resolved. So.
So the confusion with CMB is in the error bar.
Well, there's no confusion with the CMB. You're basically measuring something with the same spectrum as CMB. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks, sir, again.